This is the Pet Podcast on Pets.ca, episode number 47, Signs of Illness and Myths of Illness in Cats and Dogs. Hey there, pet lovers. How's it going? And welcome to the 47th Pet Podcast on Pets.ca. My name is Marco, and as always, we're coming to you from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. For today's show, we have another interview with Dr. Lee, where we're going to talk about signs of illness in cats and dogs and myths of illness in cats and dogs. A lot of people think they know when their cats and dogs are sick, but they really don't know when their cats and dogs are sick, and they're making some bad errors by thinking that their pets are healthy or ill when in fact they're not, and we're going to talk about all that with Dr. Lee. Before we do, I'd just like to take 2 seconds to thank all the great contributions that have been put on our bulletin board. We have a really, really active bulletin board on pets.ca. So if you do feel like joining, I would encourage you to join. We have a friendly group of people that are extremely knowledgeable, and come join our community. It's all free and it's all fun. And aside from that, we have loads and loads and loads and loads of amazingly cute pictures, and we love to share those too. So please come on by and join. The interview with Dr. Lee is about 25 minutes long, so I'm not going to talk too much in this intro, and let's just get right into the interview now. So I'd like to welcome back Dr. Lee to our podcast. It's been a few weeks, but today we're going to talk about something that's really, really interesting. We're going to talk about the signs of illness in cats and dogs, and we're going to dispel some common myths that people have with regard to illness. But before we start, welcome back, Dr. Lee.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Always a pleasure to have you and get the benefit of your amazing information. So straight off, you know, a lot of people, you know, need to know when their pets are feeling ill and they make mistakes and some of the things they do are accurate. What's like the first thing that comes to mind when people come in and say their pets are really ill? Is it often true? Are they often on the ball, or how often do they make mistakes with regard to if their pets are ill or not?
I think in general, most people are pretty accurate as far as when their pets are ill. I would say that where the problems come in is I think there's a lot of kind of myths or old wives' tales that we think about that kind of sometimes lead the people astray. But usually the underlying bond between the people and their animals, they're able to tell when the pet's not feeling well. But there are certainly some things that I think kind of lead them astray one way or the other.
Let's first get into the myths, maybe, so we just do it in order, and then we could talk about what reality is. So what would be, like, the most common myth that that you see from your end?
Well, a real common one is the nose. People will tell me that the nose is not wet, so they're sick, or that the nose is wet, and so they're sick. And there's a lot of client prognosticating of their pet's health and well-being by what the nose feels and looks like.
So let's just dispel that right away, and let's talk about dogs first. What is the normal state of a dog's nose? What should the normal state be? Does it vary by breed? Let's talk about dog noses. Does a dog's nose tell us anything about its state of health?
The nose does give us some information, but not nearly as much as some people will place emphasis on. In all the years of med school, there's not a class on noses, really, as far as the wetness or the temperature. I mean, certainly when there's discharge, I mean, you have green, yellow, pussy discharge or blood coming from the nose, obviously that is a clinical sign. But the temperature of the nose is going to be very much like the temperature of the rest of their skin. It can vary with vasodilation and vasoconstriction that really have nothing to do with, that may not have anything to do with the pet's health. Also, the wetness, I mean, certainly we can say that a moist nose is going to be with an animal that's less likely to be dehydrated, but that's probably not the best place to be looking for it. And a dry nose doesn't mean that the dog's dehydrated either. So I think it's certainly where we can get misled. The nose is the opening right into the sinus cavity. So certainly when you have diseases, disorders of the sinus cavity, we can start to see changes of the nose. There's a lot of immune-mediated diseases. But when it comes down to basic warm, cold, wet, dry, it's probably not the best place to be looking for how your pet's feeling.
So let's just say, you know, like, you know, we're giving our dog a massage and all of a sudden we just touch its nose. There's no other signs of illness. The dog is displaying no signs of illness as far as the pet owner goes. And he touches the nose and he notices that the nose is slightly warmer than normal. Doesn't mean anything. Might it mean something?
It might mean something, but that's going to be very hard to say. And so it's one of those things, you know, I think if you have anything that is a consistent, repeatable sign that seems not the way that your pet normally is, that may be a clue. I think where it comes in, I mean, I guess this is kind of a funny story, but there was a very sweet elderly lady that came to see me with her dog. And she actually brought me a whole graph that she had over the last couple weeks. And the one graph showed whether the nose was warm or cold throughout the day. And the other one was whether it was wet or dry throughout the day. And God bless her, but it was the most detailed, worthless 5 pages I'd ever seen. It really didn't help anything. I didn't really have much heart to tell her that it wasn't helping, and we ran some blood work and were able to help her pet, but the grass really didn't help a whole lot.
So just curious, do some breeds necessarily have warmer noses, or some breeds have moister noses? Is that just how it works? Or is it based on the activity of those breeds, let's say they're exercising or not, or what they're doing, as opposed to the breed itself?
Yeah, it probably has more to do with exercising and just their overall state. I mean, certainly allergies will sometimes lead to some clear discharge, but you usually, again, see other signs like sneezing. There's some dogs that obviously they have the little smushed noses, like pugs and Boston Terriers.
Yeah.
Because those noses are so close to their face, they're going to be a little bit more consistently, you know, warmer, and sometimes have more discharge just because of how the nose is made. But in general, it's more just a individual, you know, how the state is, what type of blood flow do we have going through the nose, things like that.
Okay. And is it the same with cats? Are cats any different with regard to the moisture and or the temperature of their noses?
Not really, not in this case.
So it's just really, I mean, at the end of the day, it's just a giant myth that the condition of the nose is a clear indicator of any type of health.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, let's move on. What would be like the next one that you see pretty often?
This one is probably a bit more of a dangerous one, and it's when people feel the temperature, put their hand on their pet, and use that warmth to try to determine whether or not the dog or cat is or is not running a fever. And many times people I'll be taking the pet's temperature, and the client will say, oh, you don't need that. The cat, they haven't been running a fever. They have been determining this by just how the pet feels. Or they will also feel that the pet is warm and bring them in for a fever, or worse yet, get antibiotics that they have at home and start giving it to the pet on the fact that they just felt warm.
Wow. So obviously, I mean, that's not a good indicator of health, how warm the skin feels, obviously.
Right. It has to do with vasodilation and vasoconstriction, and basically it just has to do with blood flow. One of the best examples I can think of is when you go, you know, think of the last time you were at a scary movie with somebody, and you feel you're holding their hand, and their hand's very cold because they're very scared. But that doesn't mean that their core body temperature has dropped. That is a function of vasoconstriction because of their sympathetic nervous response to what they're seeing on the video screen. Mm-hmm. So your skin can feel warm or cold based more on your blood flow patterns than it is a true temperature. So really with dogs and cats, the best way is just go down to the local drugstore and get a digital thermometer and get a rectal temperature. That's really going to be the best, most reliable way.
Okay, cool. And this has been written 1,000 times before all over our site, but because people are listening now, what's normal core body temperature for a dog and for a cat?
The cat is going to be 100 to 103. And the dog is going to be 99 to 102.5, and that's in Fahrenheit.
And then I guess just if people are going to want to know this question too, is there other ways to take a temperature in a cat or dog besides rectally, or is rectally still the best and recommended way?
Unfortunately, it's still the best and recommended way.
And if we do it, let's say we're using an old-fashioned thermometer. Let's say people have an old-fashioned thermometer. We can still use those. But a guideline might be leave it in for how long and how deep should it go?
It does not need to be very deep. With mercury thermometers, you want to have for 1 minute.
Yeah, I think I've heard the same. Just wanted to triple check with you. And before we move on, same for cats and dogs. If you touch your cat and he feels warm or she feels warm, same thing. It's just, again, could be a function of the sympathetic nervous system, or is a cat any different than a dog in that respect?
No, they're all going to be the same. And again, it doesn't mean, certainly what I'm not suggesting is that when you feel your pet and it's warm to dismiss it, but that would be then an indication to get your thermometer. Also, if your pet's not feeling well, if they don't feel warm, that definitely does not, again, if they're not feeling well, grab that thermometer, see if they are running a temperature. I certainly have had a number of dogs and cats that come in shock, and they will actually feel cold to the touch, but they can be at a 106-degree fever. And again, the reason is that when they're in shock and their sympathetic nervous system is bringing all of that blood to just maintaining the core organs, heart, brain, and the gut. And so the internal core temperature is going to be very high, but the peripheral is actually could even be cold to the touch. So there can be a wide variation between your skin temperature and your internal temperature.
Right. So it just makes perfect sense to go for the accurate diagnosis and just use a thermometer and figure out, is your pet warm or cool on the inside as opposed to the outside, which doesn't tell us all that much and has a number of possible reasons why it's not necessarily a good indication of health or sickness.
Exactly. And then always remember to label the thermometer.
To label the thermometer? How so?
For dogs and cats.
Okay. Gotcha. Very good point. Okie doke on that humorous note. What about when it comes to foods, let's say? You know, you'll have pet owners saying, you know, my cat or dog is eating too much or not eating that much. How does eating lots or not eating enough, how does that play into whether our cats or dogs may or may not be ill?
We do see a number of diseases that can increase both the appetite and the water consumption. And then there's another larger group of diseases where they just will increase water consumption. But there are a lot of people that will notice that their dog or cat is eating and has a really great appetite and will dismiss other clinical signs that may be going on, or not notice that there's a large increase in food consumption without any change of activity, may actually be constituting a disease, an underlying disease process.
I think that's actually an important point because, you know, especially maybe, I don't know if this is right or wrong to say, but sometimes older people or older generations think just because we eat well or we're eating a lot, that is a sign of health, when in reality, that can, as you've just clearly mentioned, can be a sign of sickness. I guess especially if it happens all of a sudden.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly if you have a dog and you are starting to increase activity, jogging, doing competitive frisbee throwing, I mean, if we're doing a lot of activity, likely there's going to be an increase in the amount of calories that they need. But when you start seeing a middle-aged older pet whose activity is not changing and all of a sudden their appetite is increasing, especially if at the same time we're seeing other signs like weight loss, that can be a red flag.
And obviously something that we need to like pay attention right away. And these things can be serious, right? I mean, dogs and cats can start eating more for very serious reasons. So it might well be a clear sign of illness, would you suggest?
Right. Very commonly in dogs, we will see Cushing's disease as a cause of increased appetite. And usually they will also be gaining weight at the same time, but we will see a marked increase in their appetite. Cats, very commonly, we will see high thyroid, which will be accompanied by weight loss and increased food. And then you can get diabetes, which in both dogs and cats will increase their, sometimes increase their food and water intake, and then their weight can go up or down with diabetes. So again, if we see a big change in their appetite, either an increase or decrease, that is something to bring up to your veterinarian.
Good thing to know, and I bet a lot of people would not have thought of that at all. I know vomiting can also play into this, you know, where people think that vomiting, especially in cats, is normal. Maybe we could just talk about vomiting for a little bit, if you don't mind.
That's a really good point. With cats, I do have a lot of clients that will come in, and when I'm taking the history for other issues, when I ask about vomiting, people will dismiss anything that is thrown up from a cat as a hairball. And so it's important to realize that a hairball really is that. It's going to be a ball of hair. And so if the cat is throwing up anything other than a nice big clump of hair, that's not considered a hairball, and that's actual vomiting or regurgitation. And if it's a consistent finding, that is something that we need to look at, and it will have a very different workup than hairballs.
Yes, and being a cat owner myself, I see it all the time. I know a lot of people are going to wonder straight up, what's normal with regard to a cat? I know that my cat, let's say, he probably vomits once every 2 weeks, and there's no hair in it normally. He just vomits once every 2 weeks. Could you talk about that a little bit, about maybe why cats vomit in general, and even if there is a hair or no hair? I guess it's a really general question, but how concerned should we be with regular vomiting?
Okay, no, that's a good question. Let me take the hair part first. With hairballs, there's some cats that will throw up hairballs and on a very regular basis, several times a week. There's some cats that won't do it at all, and that's going to be based upon how much, you know, length of hair. Do they have long hair? Do they have short hair? How much grooming do they have, and what type of diet they're on, and are they or are they not on hairball medication? Regardless of whether it's very frequent or infrequent, if what is coming up is consistently a ball of hair, then we really don't need to worry about medical issues. We may want to change the cat's food or put them on hairball medication, but we don't need to really rush them to the vet if that's all we're seeing.
Right.
With actual vomiting, so anything outside of balls of hair that are coming up, I do recommend that if it's a consistent finding, even if it's something that's once a month, that a physical exam and possibly blood work and fecal tests should be performed. There are some cats that they may have a mild food intolerance or just be considered as sensitive stomachs, and everything may be just fine if we're throwing up, you know, two times a month, and that may be great. But if there is an underlying issue of intestinal parasites, metabolic endocrine problems, infections, you know, that's something that we do want to take a look at.
I guess that's good to know. And I guess that's going to vary from cat to cat. So if, let's say, you know, visitors just get a brand new cat, then, and the vomiting is not hairball related, as you suggested, then, you know, the first cycle it happens, if it's been happening like once a week or once a month, then the first time you notice it happening, that would be the time, I would suggest, would be the time to bring your cat into the vet and see if the vet notices a reason why the cat is vomiting, even if it is a pattern of once a week or once a month.
I would agree. There's certainly some cats that if their lab tests and physical exams are normal and they're otherwise doing just great, vomiting once, twice a month may not be really an issue that we need to persist.
Right. It's just we need to be sure, and the best way to be sure is to go see a vet. And like you just mentioned, it could be as simple as an intolerant or a sensitive stomach, but you need to know that going in.
Absolutely. And with cats, it's always so difficult because they are so good at hiding all of their symptoms that there can be sometimes mild symptoms will be the ones that we see, will be the only thing that we will see with the cat.
Right. No, very good to know, for sure. Let's talk about dogs and vomiting just for a second, if you don't mind. How do dogs differ with regard to vomiting?
Dogs should not really be having hairballs.
Yeah, okay, good to know.
We do see, a lot of times we will see, I guess that does lead us to another myth of dogs eating grass. Dogs are omnivores. So there are some dogs that will eat grass and not vomit, and there really isn't an issue. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have a deficiency in their nutrition or that they necessarily have an upset stomach. There are some dogs that truly just love eating vegetables and grass or plants. With vomiting, again, I would put that just as we discussed with the cats. If it's a regular finding, that's something that we need to take a look at.
Right.
So there are dogs that if they're going to throw up, if they have an upset tummy, they will go out and eat grass. So if we are seeing that with the vomiting, that can be a sign of some nausea and stomach discomfort and should be taken a look at.
Right. And I guess, again, it's similar to, it's similar in a way to cats. Let's say, you know, the dog has just eaten and then he goes out to exercise a lot. I guess that exercise can upset his stomach. He'll vomit, and that might be perfectly normal. And if that's the dog's normal routine, although it's probably not the best routine to do for maybe reasons like bloat and other reasons, etc. But if it's obvious or if we recognize the pattern why our dogs are vomiting, then we've recognized the pattern. I guess that's really the trick and the key here. What is the pattern? What is the pattern due to? And I guess in a similar way to cats, it's going to make sense that the first time you notice something fishy, that's the time to go see the vet and get his or her input whether or not the vomiting is normal or due to something easily identifiable, or is it a sign of illness kind of thing.
I think that's a good point. I mean, obviously when you see a dog that's throwing up and it's because they got into the trash and then that goes away, you know, there can be some very simple reasons as to why they're throwing up. But when you have an animal that's routinely vomiting and there's not a clear, obvious sign, that is something that we do need to address.
For sure. I think we've done most of our list. Let's just get to the last part of the list. What would be the final thing that we should be aware of that it may or may not be a myth and or a sign of health for our cats and dogs?
Well, with cats, one of the big signs I do think that gets missed is just simple hiding behavior of just being reclusive. There's a lot of cats that when they are ill, they will just start to hide out, be a little bit more set by themselves, and we may not look at it as anything else. And that sometimes can be the only sign that we see until they get into a full crisis. That's very frustrating.
Yeah, and it's a very good point because even in our own case, we had a cat that had a narrow intestine, and when it went outside, it ate birds and mice and things like that. And three times, actually, the cat had obstructions, and cat no longer went out after that. Three times was the charm. But really, the key indicator that the cat was ill was that the cat was resting in a funny position in a funny location. So even speaking from personal experience, I can tell you that sometimes that is the key indicator, either, you know, as Dr. Lee mentioned, reclusiveness, or in my case, just sitting and or resting in a funny position. Is it similar with dogs? Can dogs have similar phenomenon going out, or is it mostly a behavior you'll notice with cats?
Certainly more so with cats. Dogs, because their social interaction with people is a little bit different.
Right, right.
It's a little bit more apt to let you know that they're not feeling well.
Okay. And then what about the phenomenon of, like, old pets? You know, all old pets must slow down. I guess that's got to be one of them as well. Could we maybe address that issue a little bit?
Yes, that's something that I see really commonly, where I'll see these animals that will come in, and they're actually in quite a bit of pain, but they're dismissed as just being older. And it's very difficult to tell when dogs and cats are in pain, and certainly with chronic pain like arthritis. There's a lot of older dogs that if we took away the arthritic pain, they'd probably be running out and hiking and doing all kinds of stuff. But because of the arthritis, they're just acting and walking very slow, and they're just dismissed as being older. And it's very common that when I start talking to clients, I'll get the response of, oh, no, my dog's not in pain because he never cries out. Well, it's very, I guess the analogy that I make is I can be looking at my grandmother just sitting on the couch watching TV, and to me she seems doing just fine. But when I ask her, she says that her arthritis is hurting her quite a bit, or she could even be having a migraine, and there's no way of telling from just looking. So sometimes when we start to see these older dogs slowing down, I mean, there's a lot of older dogs that are still out hiking, being very active, jogging. And so again, if we see an older dog or cat that's slowing down, that maybe there's some reasons that we can help out.
I guess it might be especially true if they're slowing down very suddenly. You know, if from 1 week to the next, the slowdown has been really noticeable.
It can be. It depends. I do think some are slowly progressive. So I think even the ones that are slower, I think even if it's not all of a sudden, I think it's worth talking to the veterinarian and taking a look at. And sometimes, you know, what we will do is we'll put them on a course of some pain medication. And sometimes we'll notice a huge difference and sometimes not. But that can certainly help us figure that out.
Good to know. And before we end, I guess let's just talk about older cats and dogs just for a few more seconds. Let's say our pets, you know, go see the vet once a year while they're growing up. Should that, you know, rate be increased as they age?
There was a campaign that a couple groups were trying to do of Think Twice for Life, and they were recommending biannual exams. I think at a very minimum, once a year. I do think one of the problems too is that we see the pets coming in for just a physical exam with the yearly vaccines. And if the vet has not been aware that we're also there to do a yearly checkup, that can sometimes be a good recommendation. Go over those concerns at that time. What is the natural activity of the animal? And have a full exam done each year.
Definitely a good recommendation in my estimation. You know, anytime we can prevent, you know, major problems from going just to see a vet once or twice a year, maybe twice as our pets age. It just makes such good sense because we can avoid, we can often deal with things more easily once we catch them, as opposed to letting things linger and having problems cause primary and or secondary damage for sure.
True. Early detection is the key.
Thanks so much, as always, Dr. Lee. I know this particular podcast is going to be really helpful because a lot of people do have these myths, in parentheses, old wives' tale about what constitutes health or sickness. And I'm glad we were able to do this, just to dispel some of those myths. So thanks so much, as always, for your input, Dr. Lee.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks, as always, to Dr. Lee for that great information. Dr. Lee has a new website out, acerlux.com, acerlux.com. Links to go in the show notes. And you could feel free to check out that site. It's in development, but there's already some good information there. And feel free to check it out. I'd also like to thank Dr. Lee again. I guess this is Thank Dr. Lee Day. But he's also been providing a lot of really good information on our forum and where he answers the occasional question. Obviously, if you're looking for emergency veterinary advice, our board or any internet board is not the place. But for questions that don't require immediate answers, either our members or occasionally Dr. Lee is on our board helping to answer questions. So thanks again to both, actually, both the members and Dr. Lee. If you like this podcast and you want to get it automatically, the easiest way to do so is to click any of the subscribe buttons on the front page of the blog. That's pets.ca/blog. And then every time we put one of these out, you'll get it automatically. If you have any comments and or suggestion, you can send them my way, pets.ca@gmail.com. And of course, you can also post in our forums. Just make your way to the forums through any of the bulletin board links on every page on pets.ca. And of course, you can comment on the blog itself, which is greatly appreciated. Thanks as always for listening, as everyone, and as always, I want you to get down on all fours and I want you to give your pets a really big hug, some beautiful pets, and just before you think you're done, give them one extra scratchy under the chin from Marco. Bye for now, everyone.